Feel free to fill up this empty seat.
So, welcome again, all of you. Thank you so much for joining, those who are coming for a second time today, those who are coming first time today. Welcome, all of you. Yeah, thanks for bringing further intimacy, proximity. So, we are continuing today with our topic of the essential truths from the Bhagavad Gita. Yesterday, we had a first gathering. Each gathering, in one sense, is independent. So if you were not able or will not be able to join all of them, still the idea is that you can grasp the essence of each gathering separately. But what we tried to do yesterday, just a brief recap for those who were not there and for those who were there as well, especially. We introduced, of course, the Bhagavad Gita as this very ancient source of wisdom that, according to the tradition, is considered to be revealed by the divine himself, and which to this day continues to be studied and applied in practice and marveled at and ruminated and meditated upon for thousands and thousands of years. So what I tried to do yesterday, and I will continue to do today, is trying to extract some of the main themes, in my opinion, that I find in the Bhagavad Gita that I've tried to present in one of my books, in my second book, Radical Personalism. So some of those themes yesterday that we touched upon was vulnerability and empowerment, and the importance of being as open, as honest, as transparent as we can in our spiritual pursuit. Also, we talk about individuation on this topic of trying to develop our sense of self as much as I can. How much of a person can we become in the context of spirituality? And we were referring, hopefully, all the while to the Bhagavad Gita to show how all the things are there in the Bhagavad Gita. So today, I was thinking about sharing two of these other main themes that I've included in my book that, again, in my opinion, are very present in the Bhagavad Gita. So one of them is the concept of guru. You may have heard about this, the concept of the spiritual teacher, preceptor, mentor, however you may like to call it. And also, of course, the concept of the, in Sanskrit, will be shishya, which means the student, because you cannot have a guru without a student. So like if I tell, okay, I'm a teacher, and you ask me, so who are your students? Oh, I never had any students. So how much you can be a teacher? How much can you be a student without a teacher? So it's a reciprocal relationship. So we'll try to address a few thoughts, share a few thoughts on this. And then in connection to this, we will go to the second topic of the day, which will be, how to call it? In my book, I call it divine ignorance, which basically means the importance of coexisting with mystery and what we don't know. In that sense, ignorance, in a sacred way. How it can be sacred to say, I don't know. Especially when we are approaching the infinite, how much we can claim, I have captured it all, right? So we will try to touch upon these two themes. Again, just a brief touch. I always like to say the nature of these topics is infinite because we are dealing with infinity itself. So we can just touch one point of an infinite line. That's, if we are able to do that, our endeavor was a success. But we should never leave a room like this thinking, okay, now I know it. Now I capture completely. If that's going on, please let me know before you leave. We'll have a more personal talk. because I don't want you to go with some misunderstanding that's in that connection. So anyhow, we'll start with talking about guru. So guru, let's first say a few words about what's guru. How do we define guru? Because sometimes some of these words, unfortunately, many times in the West, but also in India and in other places, not necessarily every person who presents himself or herself as guru is such. So many times in the name of guru, we have, again, abuse, misrepresentation, distortion. In the same way that sometimes we may say, as we say yesterday, I can say the word God. And for many of us, we may be triggered because so many horrible things have been done in the name of God. Probably the most horrible things justified in the name of the most sacred. So like one of my friends and mentors, Father Richard Rohr, Franciscan monk and author, he will say, the word God has been so much abused and misused. Probably we should give that word a holiday of 50 years. No, we should send some terms for holiday and I'll invite them to return in half a century. So we have like reboot the system, and we can approach those words for what they are originally intended and meant. So I'm saying this because even if I use the word God or if I use the word guru, let's try to be very aware that we are never speaking about those things that have a negative connotation, but all the most positive possible qualities that we can ever imagine. That's what we meant by God, by the divine, you know, the source of beauty, the source of harmony, the source of union or connection, love. And by guru, we refer to a genuine, sincere teacher, which can be, of course, can be male, can be female, just in case, because unfortunately in some lineages, still we have considerable bias in terms of teacher can only be male, or teacher can only be Swami, not a renunciant, a monk, or teacher can only be Indian, or teacher can only have long beard. No, so I'm shaven, I don't qualify. But ultimately, the symptoms of a real teacher have nothing to do with externals. Although sometimes we may be easily drawn to externals. And if someone just comes with big turban, long beard, or whatever, we may just assume, oh, that person must be spiritual. No? Or if I just enter with ashes all around my body and appear like a whatever. Each one of us will have our own ideas of that. But when we go to the Bhagavad Gita, as we will see, a qualified teacher is never defined by externals, but only by internals. In fact, in another main text of our tradition that I referred yesterday, the Bhagavad Purana, the main conversation I mentioned yesterday about this king called Parikshit, he was cursed to die in 7 days. And he was looking for a teacher to be enlightened and instructed in that last week of life. And he was a mature king. He was a world emperor, a person with experience in the world. But interestingly enough, the teacher he chose was a 16-year-old boy that just suddenly appeared on the scene naked and completely oblivious to the external environment, completely absorbed in internal reality. But the king was mature enough to see beyond the externals and see, oh, there's my guru. So again, the guru was younger than the disciple in this case and just appeared like a crazy teenager, no? Without cloth. So most of us will call police in that moment. No? But the king could see beyond the formality and realize, oh, this is a self-realized person. So a guru is... so many things we can say. The very word guru has to do with that person who dispels the ignorance. There are many ways to describe, define the word guru. The journalist dispels the ignorance by knowledge, by proper example. The guru is supposed to have knowledge, to teach, to instruct in theory, but it's also expected to have practical realization of that knowledge. It's not only about theory, but it's also... it doesn't cancel theory as well. So there is information, knowledge, theory. There is transformation, experience, insight. As one of my teachers likes to say, our guru or a guru is our own potential appearing in front of us. That's a way I like to define. There are many ways we can define guru. One way is this one. a guru, a genuine teacher, is our own potential, your own potential appear in front of you. In other words, you find such a person and you receive some kind of a portal into all that you can be. That person is showing the highest reach of yourself, of your soul, the higher depths of your heart. So ideally, a genuine guru will provide that type of experience, provide that type of, again, perspective with his, her knowledge, with his, her example. Will have that personal, undeniable experience. Wow, if in connection to that person, I'm, my existence is becoming broader. The prospect, my prospect as a soul, as a self, is enriched and going deeper, and so on and so forth. There are different gurus, of course, different types of gurus, different levels of gurus, so many ways to classify and put, compartmentalize the notion of guru. I'm trying to be a little simple today. So a guru is a teacher, a spiritual teacher. Of course, in India, guru doesn't necessarily mean a spiritual teacher. No? Teacher, a guru is a teacher. So you can have a guru in music that teaches you how to play an instrument. You can have a guru in whatever area of knowledge you are trying to master. And that will be also called guru. One's parents are ideally one's first gurus, no? If they, of course, behave ideally as parents. Unfortunately, sometimes we have to make that clarification, but a proper parent is a guru, mother, father. So actually the idea is that the Indian tradition in general brings this whole notion of a culture of gurus. Like your first guru is already, you are inside the womb of your first guru, no? Your mother, your father, this and that. So eventually the idea is, even if you may have one specific guru that instructs you spiritually, or more than one, doesn't have to be limited to one, you can have so many gurus in other realms. And the ultimate realization is to realize I'm surrounded by gurus. Everything is guru, ultimately. Yeah. The life circumstances that come to my door, no? Guru. Especially those that I label as problematic guru. They're trying to teach you something. So you ultimately, one of my teachers will say, we are invited to enter into a land of gurus, where everything is guru. Guru means, we could say also, like a channel of divine revelation, a channel of knowledge and insight. So if we have, eventually, if we as students, so to say, as disciples, train our eyes, our ears internally, we'll be able to discover gurus everywhere. What we today may consider a problem, eventually we may realize, oh, that was my guru. That came to teach me such a huge lesson. In the beginning, I was resisting so much, but eventually I realized, oh, guru. Guru here, guru there. We may need to begin with one guru, but a proper guru will, again, teach me how you are surrounded by gurus. Proper guru will never say, I am your only guru forever. You cannot learn from anyone else. I own you. If you hear all these type of things, run as fast as possible. So yeah, the proper guru is not the owner of the disciple. The proper guru is the servant of the disciple. A proper guru is serving the faith of the disciple. Sometimes we say that, no? A disciple is, or a student is having faith in the teacher, and the teacher is honoring that faith, is carving that heart, so to say, through instructions and example. So it's a mutual relationship, as we will see, no? The guru is serving the disciple by teaching, by providing an example, and the student is also serving the guru in a loving way. Ideally, it should be a very loving interaction, not a, how to say, pyramidal, hierarchical system, and the guru is on top and we are just on below, and we just to be submissive, quote unquote. and it starts to resemble more a cultish scenario than a loving, intimate interaction. That's how it's depicted in the scriptures. That's how it's depicted in the Bhagavad Gita. So I'll share with you one verse from the Bhagavad Gita, famous verse, which where Krishna speaks about guru and disciple. It's interesting because in every one of the main verses in the scripture where we find the description of the guru, you also find a description of the disciple in the same verse. Because again, you cannot speak about one without the other. So this verse is found in chapter 4, verse 34, just in case. It says, Tadvidhi pranipatena pariprashnena sevaya upadekshyanti te jnanam jnaninas tattva darshinaha. Yesterday you told me that you were okay with me torturing you with Sanskrit. Still today you are okay with that?
Yes.
Okay, such a masochist. You like torture. Sanskrit. Thank you. I love to quote the verses in its original language. So this verse basically says, if tat vidhi pranipatena, tat vidhi pranipatena, pariprashnena seve, upadekshanti te jnanam jnaninas tattva darshina. If you want to look for the truth, so then starts to immediately to show what's the qualification of the student. Before saying what's the qualification of the guru, says what's the qualification of the student, which is you have to be sincerely looking for the truth. You have to be invested in your search on some level, again, but there has to be some passionate inquiry, so to say. No, we are always inquiring in so many directions. Every single day of our lives could be described in terms of questions and answers. Every day we have questions, every day we are trying to find answers to those questions. That's how a life goes on. You can frame your life in that way, questions and answers. So here the point is made, it's important also to learn to ask questions, because we can ask so many questions that may not need to be asked. We may become too specific about something that we may not need to ask in that level of detail, in that amount of quantity. So Bhagavad Gita mentions that the actual inquiry is into the truth, into the reality of life and existence. Who am I? What is everything? What's the divine? What's my relationship with everything? How to express that relationship in practice in the most healthy, profound, sustainable way? So all these types of questions are there in the heart of the student. You come with a thirst, you come with some longing to the feet of the teacher, so to say. It cannot be forced. No? You cannot be forced to be a student. There has to be some call. So Bhagavad Gita says you have that sincerity of inquiry and you approach the guru. Tad vidhi pranipatena. Pranipat means to give yourself to the teacher, to surrender. Of course, this is a word that needs also clarification. Many times we interpret surrender in negative terms. Like if you're in a battle and the enemy is about to kill you, and you surrender. No, white flag, surrender. So it's not very positive. It's like, okay, it's my last resort, I surrender. But in this case, it should be the opposite. My surrender has to be driven by healthy prior experience that I may have with that teacher. No, it's not that I will tell you, okay, that's your teacher, surrender. It doesn't work like that. You have to know someone, and that may take time. It's not that just, okay, my teacher has to manifest in my first meeting. If in my first meeting with the teacher nothing incredible happened, then that's not my teacher. Not necessarily. I mean, it may take time. But eventually we have to have some sense of, how to say, awe and wonder. When you feel awe and wonder, you naturally surrender to that. So surrender should be prefaced by awe and wonder, not by social pressure, not by statu quo, not by, okay, whatever else is doing, not by fear, by intimidation, surrender, but just by awe and wonder. I'm in front of something so marvelous, so amazing that I just give myself to that. That's a safe place from which to surrender. You are doing it voluntarily, being profoundly touched. And that's the most effective surrender, we could say. So until and unless that hasn't happened, take your time. No, here we are not in a rush. Look, I have to get my guru as soon as possible. Because if we are in that type of guru shopping mode. Of course, there will be so many gurus available online at every corner, but that not maybe would be. Sometimes I say it also. People may ask, where is my guru? Where is my guru? But maybe the first question is, where is the disciple? Where is the student? Where am I as a student? You follow my point? Because if I'm not willing to learn, to open, to change, change, that's an important word, a heavy one sometimes. If I'm not willing to do that, probably I'm not willing to be a student. And I'm not condemning those who are there. I'm just saying, if we go to any university and the person say, okay, I want to study here, and they ask, so are you willing to learn? No. Are you willing to change your paradigms or perspectives? No. So you are not willing to learn. You cannot be a student here. It's not about discrimination or elitism, but just the minimum requirement to learn, to be open, to change, to discover. So again, sometimes instead of asking, where's the guru? We can ask, where's the disciple? I'm ready to be a disciple, to be a student, to open myself, to learn, to change. Spiritual life is about change. And change is what we need the most generally, but change is what we fear the most sometimes also. So it's part of the experience of being a student to let go and be willing to rediscover all that we can be. So, awe and wonder as preliminary to surrender. That's the first point. Pranipat. There are three things that didn't mention in this verse. Tradvidi pranipatena pariprasnena sevaya. So the disciple is invited to surrender to a guru, to surrender to a channel of truth after having this experience of awe and wonder. Then pariprasnena, which means one is the disciple is expected, the student is expected to make questions. That's important also. It's not just that you are expected to not ask questions and just listen and submit without any opinion, any critical thinking. No. Disciple, the duty of the disciple, the duty of the student is to make questions. Not by force, not like, okay, I have to force myself to have a question at the end of the lecture today. But if you are passionate about your inquiry, and you receive knowledge, naturally there may be questions about how to implement that or things you didn't understand, anything and everything. All questions are welcome. And the guru should create that safe space where people feel, I can ask anything and it's okay. Because sometimes people is afraid of asking questions. I have done meetings like this thousands of times, and generally I try to conclude with questions, invite for questions. And sometimes I can perceive that people have questions, but they're afraid to make the question because they may feel it's a silly question. No, it's not too profound. And it's not silly probably, but they feel like that. But always, if the question is necessary for you, if you need to make the question, then it's not silly. It cannot be silly. It's your way of presenting yourself sincerely, no? I'm just saying that in case you already have questions. Whether at the end or if it's a very pressing question, you just raise your hand and we can continue talking. So naturally, there can be questions presented by this, not in a challenging mode, because again, first, there should have been, again, this awe and wonder, this surrender, this trust. So if I trust someone deeply and admire someone deeply, my questions will come from a very respectful place, no? Very trustful place, very intimate place. But first of all, again, we have to have this foundation of trust and faith. Now, the word faith is an important word. In Sanskrit, it's shraddha, actually. Sometimes it's difficult to translate these words into any other language apart from Sanskrit. No, because shraddha means like to present our hearts to the divine, not to give ourselves as an offering. So again, the word is shraddha in Sanskrit, shraddha, mm-hmm. Which basically means that I'm bringing myself, I am the offering, so to say. I offer myself. But again, for that to happen, first there has to be some experience that is building trust. So if we want to translate Shraddha as faith, faith is generally described as the trust that comes from experience. You have an experience and naturally have faith in that experience, in that person. Faith is not the same as belief. Belief is something that, like a mental conviction I can have. Like I can say, I believe, like someone asked once, I remember Carl Jung, do you believe in God? And he say, no, I don't believe in God. I know that he exists. He make the different point. No? It's not the same to say, I believe in something and I have a direct experience of something, right? Like, for example, what's your name?
Daniel.
So if someone asks me, do you believe in Danny's existence? And it's like, no, it's not that I believe or I don't believe. I met him personally. You follow my point? It's not the same to believe in someone, in something, and to know the person, to have an experience. So when we speak about faith, for example, here, faith in the guru, it's not so much to have a belief that I believe that that person is this and that, and it's my own probably imagination. It's more, I have an experience and I trust my own experience ultimately. It was so undeniable. Ultimately, all of us are driven by our own experience. Even in relation to the guru, even in relation to anything, what you are experiencing is what dictates whether I give myself here or not, I open myself here or not, I go deeper here or not. So that's very important. The Bhagavad Gita says in the chapter 17, chapter verse 28, Shraddhayahutam datam tapastaptam kritam chayat asaditi uchate partanachyata pratyanoiha. Whether you do sacrifice, charity, offering, whatever you do, if it's without faith, if it's without proper experience and conviction, Krishna uses strong words, it's useless. Like implying, I don't know, I'm engaged in a spiritual practice, but I have no faith in what I'm doing. I have had no experience. I'm just doing it externally, mechanically. Krishna says that amounts to nothing. No, there has to be an internal conviction, an internal experience that takes me to do things from a substantial place. So a real guru will invite the student to be a real person, to ask questions, as we were saying, whatever needs to be man presented. For example, in this verse 72 of 18th chapter of the Gita, it's very beautiful because Krishna, after speaking the whole Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna, and Krishna here is acting as a guru. No? The whole Bhagavad Gita is Krishna represents the guru figure, Arjuna represents the Sishya or the disciple. And after speaking the whole Bhagavad Gita, basically, we are verse 72 of the last chapter, the last verse is 78, so almost concluding. So Krishna is saying what to Arjuna? He's saying, have you understood all that I've said? Like implying, if you don't, I speak the whole thing again. Like that's the willingness of a real master. No, it's not like, okay, this is the lesson. You got it, right? Good luck. Good luck. See you in the next one. And it's like, I have 108 questions. The real teacher should say, bring all those questions. Let's talk about it again all the times that they're necessary. That's a genuine grace of the teacher. The teacher is not like impatient, like, why you are not understanding things so quickly? If everyone is sincere, time is secondary. How long does it take to learn the lesson? If there is sincerity of presence, that's the most important thing. So the willingness of a genuine teacher is to repeat the lesson again and again, all the times that are is necessary. And to be honest, many times we need to listen the same thing again and again. We are very expert at forgetting and become distracted, or the same lesson again and again will never be the same lesson at the same time. Like Bhagavad Gita. I've read Bhagavad Gita, I don't know, 30, 40 times. It's never the same Bhagavad Gita. It's always the same, but it's never the same. So that's also an important point. And a few verses before that, Again, going back to the spirit of the disciple, in verse 63 of this last chapter, Asheshena, there's this word's very important, which means endlessly, without end, which describes how comprehensive should be the inquiry of the disciple. Endlessly. The student is invited to ask without end. Why? Because the subject matter we are studying is infinity itself, which has no end. So there is no end to how much we can learn, ask, reply, and so on and so forth. And again, we should be willing, even when we think, I've learned the lesson, we should be willing to keep, and we will go there in a minute, to the second theme today. We should be able to keep some humility and some open door to, okay, I think I understood what the lesson said, but I'm sure there's something that I'm not even seeing at this point. Not, you follow my point? It's not that I understood it completely. Next lesson. Every single lesson is unlimited. Even if we move to another lesson, everything is and has endless depths, endless breadth, and so on. So guru is doing his part, her part. Student is invited to do his part, her part. And guru, ideally, not only is a teacher, but sometimes if the disciple, the student is very sincere, something very high, incredible can come through the disciple, through the student, and the guru is humble enough to learn from that. As I mentioned in my book, Radical Personalism, the guru has one of the symptoms. Ideally, a guru is more advanced than the student in one sense, but one of the symptoms of someone more advanced is you will have more capacity to learn. No? So if the guru is more advanced than the disciple, the guru will be learning more from the disciple than what the disciple may be learning from the guru. No. Maybe the disciple is learning a lot, but the guru is learning probably much more. So it's not a one-way street. It's not just guru teaches, disciple learns, that's it. It's mutual, it's reciprocal. A real teacher remains a student forever, as we were saying yesterday. Remains a disciple forever. So, and the real teacher also, again, invites the disciple to offer feedback, to offer input. At the very end of the Bhagavad Gita, also verse 63, Krishna is saying, Arjuna, so I've given this knowledge to you. Now, please, you deliberate on that fully. Think about what I've shared and then act accordingly. So it's not that Krishna, the guru, is saying, I told you this, now do that. You have no option. You have no free will. No, the teacher is saying, I gave you this knowledge. Think about that. Use your own faculties and reach your own conclusion and decision and act accordingly. And if you need me to repeat everything again, return and we talk again about it. Something like that. And the third point of this verse that I started quoting the Gita about Guru and Disciple 434 says, first, as we say, the student surrenders to the guru, inquires humbly, and sevaya. Sevaya means, comes from the word seva. It's a very nice word in Sanskrit, seva, which again is loosely translated as service. It's okay, it's a nice word, also service. But seva means more than that. It's service, but what do we mean by service? We have military service. We have different forms of service in society. So seva means to give pleasure to the object of your affection. Let's put it that way. Seva, S-E-B-A. Yeah. So seva means to give pleasure to the object of your affection. So it implies that there is some affection, there is some relationship, and you want to please that person from all your heart, voluntarily. You want to give satisfaction, give the best you can give to that person, which we translate as service. You offer service to the person. You give yourself in service, which, as we say, is reciprocal. is reciprocal. So if a disciple or a student is invited to give his, her life in service to the teacher, that can only happen if the teacher is already doing that to begin with. It's giving his, her life in service to the disciple by giving the teaching, by giving him the example, and so on and so on, so forth. So this service to the teacher is just the, how to say, the returning of the embrace. As I like to say, the gift has come, and you realize the gift that I'm receiving is unparalleled. So the only question that remains is, what can I do to give back? That's ideal spirit. No? An ideal disciple will feel, I have been gifted with so much that my only question now is how to reciprocate. Imagine if someone gives you the most valuable gift possible, beyond your own imagination of that, in abundance, eternally. So probably at one point you start to feel uncomfortable about just receiving. And you start to feel like yesterday, right? Yesterday we were, after the meeting, we were to eat something here nearby. We're a little hungry. And not nearby, it was nearby our place. And we gave to you some of these cookies, remember yesterday? So you didn't eat all those cookies, so we have a few left. So we have one each of us. And then Trip was thinking, not thinking, just naturally. He doesn't need to think these things. He just took a few cookies and he started to give cookies to the girls who were attending the place where we bought food. And so he gave one to one, one to another. He explained the recipe. They were asking about the recipe, of course. They were too good not to get the recipe. and then they didn't ask the recipe yet. They just tasted it. It's like, good. So then they asked.
I asked.
Okay. Good. Very good. So after tasting that, they asked, oh, what's the recipe? So, and he gave the recipe, of course. And I was joking and told him, oh, that asking for the recipe is a subliminal message that they want more cookies. No? So he took one more, he started to give cookies again. And they felt like, no. Like, again, they felt kind of embarrassed of receiving so much, what we were talking here. You know? And at one point they were like, okay, but let me give you something myself. No? So they gave us some extra piece of food, so to say, to reciprocate. So it was beautiful because naturally you could feel like there's a point that you feel I'm receiving so much. I want to be part of this. I want to participate. You know, like you are having so much fun giving. I also want to give. I want to also to taste the pleasure of giving. You know? Receiving is beautiful. Giving is beautiful. Honestly. So that's the point I want to make with last night's example. The disciple, the student is feeling, wow, I've been gifted with so much that my only question is how to reciprocate. Interestingly, in Sanskrit, the word for servant, no? Servant in this connection, no? A servant, a service, offering service to others, servant, one of the words is kimkara. So kimkara in Sanskrit, kimkara. Kara means to do, and kim means what. So kimkara means what to do. What can I do? Implying the spirit of a servant, kimkara, is what can I do? Like, how can I serve you? That's the only question one has, because that person feels, I received so much. That the only question I have from now on is, how can I give myself? How can I reciprocate? So, again, if properly expressed in a healthy, affectionate relationship, this spirit is so beautiful, so desirable. So the guru in this way represents kind of a, we will say, God's grace personified. No? Like sometimes we talk about the divine, talk about divine grace, divine love. But many of us may have some difficulty in how to say. We hear that and may sound still a little bit abstract to some. But as one teacher once said, it may be easy, relatively easy to, comparatively easy, to deny God's existence. But when you find someone who has love for God, that's more difficult to deny. No? Well, I say, okay, I don't see God, it's not here, doesn't exist. But if you meet in person someone who is full of this presence and love, and it's more difficult to say. I'm not saying that that doesn't exist. So guru is supposed to be one of those personalities. So embodying grace, embodying mercy, embodying compassion, embodying patience, tolerance, love, knowledge, so many things. And part of the grace, and here I'm connected with our second topic, part of the gifts that the guru will give, of course, will be in the form of knowledge, will be in the form of answers to our questions, but sometimes also part of the knowledge that the guru will give will be in the form of not answers, but questions. A guru not necessarily is there to clarify everything, to bring closure to everything, but to bring disclosure, to leave the field open, to assure that the disciple is not reaching this place of, okay, I now know it, but to leave always the student in an open spirit. You can always discover this more. You can always go deeper. And for this, sometimes the guru will create new doubts in the student. When the student starts to think, to become very sure about what he thinks he knows, we will say something else. So the disciple will be like, oh my gosh, I don't understand anything now. Good boy. No? You follow my point? So sometimes we need to be humbled in our sense of certainty. Sometimes we are certainty junkies, no? Addicted to certainty. Everything has to be certain, clear, controllable. And again, we are dealing with the infinite here. So the guru tries to keep us in a more fluid space. So when we are becoming too rigid, too certain, something will come from the teacher to create a new perspective, create a new paradigm. And invite us to this concept that I mentioned before, divine ignorance. How to embrace not knowing, the importance of unknowing in order to know. Many times, if we want to know certain things, many times we first need to unknow a long list of things, because each of us brings our own baggage of assumptions and things we think is like this, is like that. So sometimes the role of the guru is to deconstruct and dismantle our set of bias and prejudice and assumptions so we can start from blank page. Affectionately, again, and in a sustainable way, because sometimes our whole orientation to life is based on certain ideas. So it may be too much if we are shaking from all that in only one lesson, our whole worldview may collapse, and who can survive that? And so it's a whole art to gradually move and show and suggest how things could be a little different than how we are seeing things many times. Because that's the paradox, all right? We may approach a teacher looking for answers or looking for knowledge or looking for relief and certain experiences because we are suffering sometimes. And the teacher will try to teach us, okay, if you are suffering, that means that there is something that you may need to change because the suffering is created by your own perception of things. And for that to stop happening, we need to change. We need to change our perspective. Like once, one of my teachers was approached and someone asked him, remember, we were talking about service. So one student of this teacher came and asked him, please, Guru, Gurudev, can you give me some service? And he replied, change your angle of vision. That was a service. And this disciple thought, okay, maybe my guru will send me to wash pots, to clean the room, to cook something, to do something, one act performance, one thing. And the guru said, change your angle of vision. He gave him service for eternity by that instruction. Because when you change your angle of vision, in one sense, you no longer need to ask for service because you realize whatever is in front of me are service opportunities. Everything becomes service. especially again, problems. What I like to call problems, why not reframe them as service opportunities? Portals to change. We just like to label them problems. And we create the problem by labeling them problems many times. So anyhow, going back to this topic to conclude today's lecture, the guru keeps the student in a humble, open place, trying to bring sacred doubt, let's call it that way. We need to clear doubts, but sometimes guru will create new doubts. Not doubts in the whole practice or in the, but in how we are understanding things. So we are not so sure, excessively certain about things. We remain in a more flexible place. Not like, again, one of my teachers will say, what's the opposite of faith? I'm asking you now, tell me.
Fear.
Fear, that's a good way of replying, but I'm looking for another answer. But it's good, correct? Sleep. Ignorance.
Accepticism.
Okay. Doubt. Okay, I want to get that one. Which is not the right answer. So sorry, I'm using you to I needed someone to say that. I was just waiting. Sometimes we can think, not only you, we can think, okay, the opposite of faith is doubt. And this teacher will say, the opposite of faith is certainty.
Certainty.
Mm. Certeza. I also speak Spanish, just in case. And what's his point? Right? Because many times we think, no, faith should be certainty. He said, no. Faith, the opposite of faith is certainty. Certainty means I'm trying to control, to know everything is in place, everything is certain, predictable. Mm. Faith has more to do with dealing with mystery, with the openness to relate to what I don't know, to the willingness to enter that liminal space, sometimes it's called. No. That's more faith. It's not so much being certain about everything. Because sometimes many people in the name of faith, their faith is just being certain about everything. Everything is predictable, under control, but faith is the opposite of that. You follow my point?
Like trust in something.
Sorry again?
Like trust in something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I like to say sometimes faith is having patience with mystery. You are relating with something that is mysterious. Mysterious means it's beyond your understanding, beyond your control. It's not something that you can just grab and explain and control as you like. It's just too big to do that, too deep, too profound. It's a mystery. I may know something, but it still is a mystery. Like I can say, okay, I know something about God, but I ignore more than what I know, right? I know something about you. I know something about myself. But probably there's so much more that I don't know. And I need to be okay with that. So faith can be translated as being patient with mystery. Relating with something that is mysterious, and it's okay. We don't need to become like unsettled and excited. I can have patience. And patience has to do with trusting while I wait. Because sometimes patience for some of us is like, okay, I have to wait, I have to be patient. And I'm like an anxiety waiting for everything to become certain. But patience can be also, again, this idea of I'm waiting, I'm coexisting with mystery, I'm relating to the unknown, and I'm trusting that. I'm trusting that everything will unfold naturally. That's my patience. I'm trusting while waiting. There's trust, there's confidence. It's not anxiety, impatience. Because if I'm impatient, that shows I'm not trusting reality. And of course, we all fail in that. So it's okay. Welcome to the club. No? But gradually, we need to learn the art of patience. In Spanish, we'll say paciencia. We could make the play of words, la ciencia de la paz. La paz, ciencia. Sorry, you were raising your hand.
Yes, and it has to be in this trusting It has to be something about intuition.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Intuition.
Ask the question in Spanish to see if I understood correctly.
Si tiene que ver, si entra la intuición.
Mm-hmm.
En la fe.
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course. ¿Sí? Yes. Yeah, because as I said, faith has to do with the trust that comes after having an experience. So sometimes in an experience with whomever, I will feel certain things. No? And again, sometimes I may not be able to trust. And that's okay. What I'm talking here is it's not about just trust everything and everyone. Unfortunately, we cannot trust everything and everyone. We can trust the overall scheme of reality. We can trust reality is not against me. The divine is not against me. But some people, unfortunately, are disaligned with that. And because of that, I cannot fully give myself to them. Because that will, and they don't know how to respond to that. As we were talking yesterday, when we talk about vulnerability, it's healthy and empowering to open ourselves fully to someone else. But that someone else has to be capable of receiving us fully. If that's not happening, it's not recommended to just open myself to everything, everyone and anyone. Yes.
And regarding this faith thing, when you said that, like the waiting for patiently for the mystery, I will think that faith is more that trusting something that you experience, but then the waiting is more like hoping that will be made. Like for me, those are different concepts. But you said that faith was also the waiting.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you for the further nuanced. Yeah, I will say that I will connect the two. I appreciate your differentiation, but I will say that also if I have hope in something being a certain way, it's because I've had before that some experience on which I had faith that lends me to have hope.
Exactly.
So in that sense, I wouldn't totally separate them, but okay, we can talk about them like two different things, but at the same time, I will be careful not to make them entirely different.
Yeah.
Because again, if I have hope, genuine hope, not just my own imagination, but realistic hope, is on the basis of what I've already experienced, right? And that creates faith, trust in that experience that makes me think, okay, in the future, so to say, hope goes more into the future. Yeah, I trust that that will happen in this way. Yeah. So, secret, in the Bhagavad Gita, let's go to the Bhagavad Gita. We are supposed to be talking about the Bhagavad Gita. And we are talking about the Bhagavad Gita all moment, just that I don't want to make it too torturous by quoting one verse after 2 minutes. But there are verses to quote after 2 minutes in all that we are talking. I'm just picking the main ones. So in the 9th chapter, 2nd verse, Krishna is saying, he's describing bhakti. He's describing the science of love. And Krishna says, Raja Vidya Raja Guhyam Pavitra Midamuttamam Pratyaksha Vagamam Dharmyam Sushukam Kartamabhyam. There's so much to say in that verse, so much to unpack. But he's describing the yoga of love, the yoga of devotion, bhakti, as something that is understood by personal experience. We were already talking about that. You need to have your own personal experience, something that is to be practiced with joy, susukam kartum, no? And he begins saying this love, this divine love, Raja Vidya Raja Guhyam, is the king. Raja means king, a vidya of all knowledge or all education, Raja Guhyam, and it's the king of Guhya. Guhya means secret. So love is the king of all knowledge. In other words, if I love you, I know you in the most profound way. Knowledge is about knowing, but knowing is not limited to our intellectual faculties. When I love someone, that's the most comprehensive knowledge I can have. So that's why love is compared to the best knowledge. So if we want to really know things, we are invited to love things. You follow my point? I can know you technically, your name, your passport number, where you live, the genealogical tree, all the technical info. But if I don't love you, I'm missing basically 90.99999% of who you are, actually. Right? It's like taking an apple and studying the apple externally and reaching so many conclusions, but I never tasted the apple. That's the comprehensive knowing of what's an apple, so to say. So tasting reality, so to say, giving a bite to reality, is love, loving. That's how we can really experience things for what they are. And this love is Rajaguhyam, is the king of all secrets, Krishna says. It's the most confidential secret things are connected to this idea, to love. So Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita is saying that. And there are many other verses in the Bhagavad Gita. If someone wants, then I can provide you the numbers later. When Krishna is speaking about what he's sharing to Arjuna on different degrees of guhya or secrecy, like what I'm sharing to you is secret, is mysterious, is confidential. It's something that in one sense you cannot just fully capture it. Again, you have to be okay coexisting with what you don't know. It's healthy. As we say yesterday, Krishna will say, among all secrets, I'm silence. So you may have heard this word, some of you at least in Sanskrit, the word Upanishad. Okay. So Upanishad refers to the, let's say, the metaphysical portion of the Vedas. So these are metaphysical, philosophical texts of the Vedas. Very interesting. The Bhagavad Gita itself is called as Gita Upanishad. So it contains the essence of all Upanishads. There is a very famous verse from the Gita Mahatmya, Sarva Upanishado Gavo Dukda Gopala Nandana Partha Vatsa Sudhira Bhokta Dukdam Gitamritam Mahat. Gives an analogy. It says, all the Upanishads are like a cow. No? In India, you have cow, sacred cow everywhere. So the cow, the Upanishad, all the sacred texts are like a cow. Krishna, Dukda, Gopala Nandana. Krishna is like the milker of the cow. Follow the analogy. Right? Arjuna, the student, is Vatsa, is the calf. So whenever you bring the calf closer, the cow gives milk. Right? So Arjuna is the calf. Krishna is the Upanishads are the cow. Krishna is the milker. And the message of the Bhagavad Gita is the milk that comes from milking the essence of the Upanishads, not by Krishna milking that. So in that way, the Bhagavad Gita is considered the essence of all Upanishads. And what does Upanishad mean? That's my point. Upanishad, in Sanskrit, you have these three parts of the word. Upa-ni-shad. Have a question?
No.
I'm talking about the Sanskrit word called Upanishad. Upanishad are a series of texts, of sacred texts in the yogic tradition. Yeah, thanks for the question. Yeah, I don't want you to think that I'm talking about punishment for the next 10 minutes. It sounds like punishment, right? Upanishad. No. Upanishad. So Upanishad means Upa ni shat. No? So upa means sit, to sit. Ni means not close. Upa means close. Upa. Ni means to sit. And sat means to sit. Ni means close and sat means. Ni also means not, but also ni means something. Upa means close. Shat means to sit. And it also means down. So Upanishad means sit down, close. Sit down, close. So what's the implication of that? Sit down, close means I'll tell you a secret. If I will tell you a secret, I won't just pick the microphone here. I will tell you, come. So Upanishad, the implication is secret is about to be revealed, something mysterious, something that is not easily to comprehend. And even when you get a glimpse of that, you should be very careful not to conclude, I already understand it. There's a story shared in our tradition in this connection of a teacher, a father and a son. So the two are there, all rural in India. So the boy wants to study. He's thinking about what to study. And he's talking with his father, and his father is a spiritual, very spiritual person. So the boy tells him, I want to study whatever, this career and this career, to become an accountant or whatever. Just pick whatever you like. And the father says, I want to obtain real education, he says. So I want to study this. And the father says, real education, please first educate yourself spiritually. So I will send you to this. I recommend that you go to this spiritual teacher and you learn this particular book. In our tradition, we call it the Bhagavad Purana. But we can use the Bhagavad Gita, no problem. To follow more, to fit more our conversation. So go and study the Bhagavad Gita and you will get real education. And other educations are okay, but please get the foundation here. So the boy obeys his father, trusts his father, and goes for a year to study Bhagavad Gita. And then after a year, returns home. So the father asks him how it was. He says, I thought that education was something else. But now that I studied Bhagavad Gita, I really understand what's education. So thanks so much for sending me to study Bhagavad Gita. And the father asks, so did you understand Bhagavad Gita? Mm-hmm. I say, yes, thank you, Dad. His father said, go again and study Bhagavad Gita. So the boy falls and goes again. Another year passes and he returns back, no? With more enthusiasm than the time before. No? So he says, so did you study Bhagavad Gita? Yes. Did you understand Bhagavad Gita? Yeah, first time I thought I understand Bhagavad Gita. And now that I've gone a second time, I realize I didn't understand anything. So the father, so now you understood Bhagavad Gita after a second time? I said, yes, finally I understood. Thank you, Dad. Father said, go again and study Bhagavad Gita. So the boy goes again for a third time. And here in Spain, you have this saying, la tercera es la vencida. Okay. He goes for a third time and returns. But the third time he's returning more like, not so much like, I know it all, but just like low profile. So his father says, so did you study Bhagavad Gita? Yes. Did you understand Bhagavad Gita? He said, no. I realize I cannot understand Bhagavad Gita. Mm-hmm. His father said, okay, you have understood Bhagavad Gita. So that's basically the spirit, right? Socrates famously will say, I only know that I don't know. And when you study his life, you realize he knows. He knew a lot. But the more you know, the more, not only know in terms, again, of theory, but the wiser you get, the more humble you become. And the less you dare to say, I know, because there's so much more. You are getting closer to the infinite. That's what one of my teachers, Bhakti Rakshak Siddhartha Goswami, he will say, the closer you get to the infinite, the more you will realize there is no limit to the progress you can make. Try to imagine that. And he says, that's overwhelming in itself. You get to the infinite, you realize there is no limit. So how much I can claim, I know. I got it. It's like, I was just by grace able to touch one point of an infinite life. So in this way, a genuine teacher will try to inspire the student in that direction. No? Remain open, remain humble, remain willing to learn, and remain, open to question your understandings, as we were saying before, especially if we're talking about God. Many times, as I said, in order to know God, first we have to unknow God. No? We may need first to discard so many wrong assumptions about what the divine is, so many projections, sometimes so many unresolved trauma from childhood with authority figures, then that take us to project that same thing to the ultimate authority figure, so to say. And we may need to deconstruct all that. As I like to say, many people actually some of the main arguments for those who do not believe in God, so to say. People will say, I don't believe in God because God cannot be like this, 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 this. I cannot believe in that. And I will say, I cannot believe in that either. That cannot be God. That cannot be the divine. And unfortunately, many theistic believers, they embrace an idea of God that, in my opinion, is utterly unbelievable. No? The same idea of God that makes someone an atheist, some other people chooses to believe, to become a believer because of that idea. And that's dangerous for me. So, so in that way, we are invited to, we are related to something very, very deep, very profound, in constant growth and expansion. That's another point. And with this, I'm trying to conclude and ask if you have any questions. But as you may have heard the word Upanishad, you may have heard, especially in the Upanishads, one word to refer to the absolute is Brahman. You heard the word Brahman? Okay. So that's a very interesting word, because Brahman, the dhatu, or the Sanskrit root from which Brahman comes, is Brim. Brim means to expand or to grow. So Brahman means that which is in constant expansion and growth, and who makes others grow and expand, if you contact that. So in other words, Brahman is a name for the divine, for the absolute, however you may like to call it. And it's referring to a reality that is in an ongoing expansion. It's not that it's always the same thing, which is an important point. Actually, I'm finishing writing my third book, which is all about this topic, how reality is in constant evolution, growth, and expansion. And many times we see things just as this is it, this is God, this is me, this is the world of matter. But whether matter, material energy, the divine, us, everything is in constant movement and unfolding. So Brahman means that. It means something that is ever-evolving. So how can I claim, I fully know that person, I fully know that reality, if it's in constant expansion? We just can try to keep the pace, no? Como seguirle el ritmo. Keep the pace of something that is in constant evolution. But it's never a point where we can claim, I got it. I've colonized it and I put my flag there. Because it always becomes something more at the next moment. In our tradition, we will say very nicely, we'll be talking about Krishna, the speaker of the Bhagavad Gita. And it is describing one book that the beauty of Krishna is in constant expansion, which I know is difficult to imagine. Try to imagine someone who at every nanosecond becomes more beautiful. It's like, what? So the scriptures say that's Krishna. Krishna means Krishna, the name Krishna means the all attractive. And all attractive means doesn't mean that he's all attractive and doesn't become more attractive, he's in constant expansion. So it is described, Krishna becomes more beautiful at every moment, and his devotees, like Arjuna or others, in response to that increased beauty, they increase their love. And when they increase their love, they offer their love to him, and that offer love makes him more beautiful again. So their beauty continues to increase, and their love continues to increase, and so on and so forth. And the verse concludes, and the both of them, the two of them, Krishna and his lovers, engage in a competition in which none of them accept defeat. So Krishna's beauty continues to increase forever, and the love of the devotees continues to increase forever. It's an ever-evolving thing. So that's the invitation to embrace something that is continues to grow, to continues to create new possibilities, new experiences. That's at least for me what makes eternity exciting. Because if eternity will be something that is always the same, that sounds more like hell than heaven. But if eternity is something in constant expansion and growth and deepening and evolution, it's like, okay, I'm fine going there. Let's go there. So in that sense, in one sense, reality, ultimate reality, is a perpetual mystery because it always continues to grow and expand. So there's always something new to discover, something new to learn. Like my friend and mentor Richard Rohr will say, it's not that a mystery, we are talking about mystery, he say, a mystery is not something that we cannot understand. A mystery is something that we can understand endlessly. It's not the same.
What's the meaning of that?
Endlessly, sin fin, ilimitadamente. So a mystery is not something that you cannot understand, but that can be understood in so many unlimited ways. So that's the point we are going here. We are not saying here, you cannot understand anything. We are here trying to understand something. But part of the understanding is that it can always be more understood, more realized, more experienced. So Bhagavad Gita is trying to make that point many, many times. Krishna says in 7th chapter, I know everyone, but me, nobody knows, he says. That's pretty mysterious, right? I know everyone, everything, but me, nobody knows. Like implying, like I remain a mystery always on some level. And that invites for a further discovery, a further disclosure, and so on and so forth. You know, some thoughts I want to share today. So many more things come, but I also had to learn to contain myself and not overwhelm the audience. And also invite you, if you have any further questions apart from the ones we've shared so far, questions, some topics, something, thoughts, comments, whatever you may like to share. We have a few minutes. So after all that I say today about the importance of questions, there are no silly questions, remember? So yeah, feel free to ask.
As per yesterday, I wanted to know, in your opinion, how do you put balance and also being present into practice in your daily life?
Okay, how do I put balance and being present in my practice in my daily life? Well, thank you. Okay. As I always try to say, no, there is no magical formula to this. So it's a practice. No? You have to practice presence. You have to practice balance. It's an ongoing journey. So that's first thing. No? It's not just like, here goes the magical formula. You got it. You are there. That's it. No? But it's a daily, we call that sadhana. Sadhana means practice in Sanskrit. Sometimes we just limit the idea of sadhana to my daily mantra recitation or my daily, sitting for meditation. But actually sadhana is 24/7. No? Sadhana at one point ideally should be your life, not just your practice and your life. But your practice becomes your life becomes your practice, and you cannot just separate between the two. So that's my point when I say, how do I practice presence? It's an ongoing situation, like now I'm talking to you and to all of you. So I have to be present, to allow myself to listen to you, to be as empathic as I can, to not judge, to not label, which I'm not saying is easy. And we many times we fail. So it takes willingness to, it may be painful, but willingness to acknowledge when we are failing in that also. Like, okay, I want to be present. To be present means to receive what's going on without, for example, labeling it, whether from other people or even from myself. You know, like even if you sit on a daily basis to meditate or to pray, whatever your practice, part of that sitting is, again, to be present now, here, and to allow whatever is coming in the present moment, you know, thoughts, feelings, situations, and may not be the highest thing, but you cannot deny them. You know, we cannot. So presence means also acceptance, right? And not labeling, allowing things to be. It sounds easy, but it's not so easy. I remember 20 years ago, I was studying this book, Nonviolent Communication from Marshall Rosenberg. And he mentions different things, but he gives a four-step process in this connection. And the first step, the four, is observe reality without judging. I said, oh, that's it? Try. Try and fail miserably. Try and be humbled by your failure, which is okay. We also need to fail and be humbled by our failure. But it's important to try just, okay, even as something as simple as just watch the tree and the birds in the window and do not label anything. Do not say, I like, I don't like, it's good, it's bad, it's windy. It's just observe. Just allow reality for what it is to be present and you to be present to that. And again, sounds simple, and it's simple, but we are not simple. So what's simple is complicated for us. Not because it's complicated, we are complicated. So we are trying to simplify ourselves. So, being present is a daily practice. Even you can call it daily struggle on some level. You have, like, I don't know, meditating or chanting your mantra. Sometimes you will see the mind is going. As I like to say, the mind goes shopping. And you may be supposed to be here, present, meditating, praying, and your mind went shopping for 15 minutes, and you didn't even realize that. That's the most interestingly embarrassing thing. So after 15 minutes, you realize, oh my God, no, I got completely kidnapped for 15 minutes. I never realized it. Maybe externally, I continue reciting my mantra or doing whatever, but I was somewhere else. Again, it's embarrassing, but it's what it is. So you have to acknowledge that and return to the present moment. And try to understand the depth of the present, because generally we go to the future and to the past. And we inhabit so much time in those two places, so much excessive time in those two. I'm not saying never go there, but go there as much as it's required. If not, you can die of an overdose of past and future. As we were talking yesterday, sattva, rajas, and tamas. So rajas has a lot to do with future, with projection, with what will happen, and of course with anxiety about what will happen, what may happen, may not happen, trying to control the outcome, attachment to the result, rajas. And tamas has to do with the past many times, nostalgia, going back, trying to change things that cannot be changed in the past. So the ideal balance of those two is sattva, which means present moment. In the present moment, you receive the exact dose you need of past and future. Because in the present, you are receiving the fruits of your past actions. So they are coming in the present moment. Your past is coming in the present moment. The result of our previous choices create, let's say, pattern of thoughts that are with us here and now, but they came from our past decisions. So that's the past portion we need, and we need to deal. And future means whatever I want or I don't want for the future, it can only be created in the present. So again, that's the way future has to be dealt with in the present. If we go beyond that, we just are doing bypassing. We are just escapism of the present. Just future, past. But to have a real, actual experience, that can only happen in the present. You cannot have a real experience in the past or in the future. So the only real, profound experience you can have is in the present, by being the present. So a few thoughts that may help to that. And balance, one word just about that, balance, how to keep balance in a daily life. Oh, that's not easy, right? But it's important, it's necessary, and every day is different. No? So what gives balance today may not be the same formulas for tomorrow. So again, I'm not a friend of conclusive formulas. It requires presence, it requires presence brings balance. By being present to the day, to where I am, to what I need, I can try to go through my day in the most balanced way possible. Of course, some practices and habits are important as much as we can. But again, what's balanced for some person may not be balanced for others. So also be careful to compare yourself with others, because what's balancing for someone may be completely disturbing for you, so to say. But for some person is normal, a middle point, for you maybe an extreme. So we have to observe ourselves today. What's my balance? Again, as we were talking yesterday, some days I may need recreation. Like Krishna said, you have to be balancing your recreation. That doesn't mean that every day I have recreation all day. No. Sometimes I may not have time for recreation because my dharma is calling me, as we were saying yesterday. No. But also that doesn't mean I will never have recreation. But some days, so every day is different. So balance is trying to keep that middle point where we are not losing sight of, I will use these words, purpose and meaning. For me, they are two important words. How you live your day in a purposeful way. Now, don't go through your day without any purpose and meaning. Like it was a day that you look back and it's like, oh, there's nothing that I can say about that day. That's not the idea. Mm-hmm. So ideally, we have to have, because every day can be the last also. Sorry, I don't want to sound tragic, just realistic. As this famous Chinese proverb says, it's a little tragicomical, but it says, live every day as if it's the last, and one day you will be correct. Right? So the last, again, the soul is eternal and so on and so forth. But at the same time, yeah, let's honor time. Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita says, I am time. God is not different from time. So for us to honor time properly is a way of honoring the divine. So yeah. Balance for me is to remain in that place where I'm not losing sight of purpose and meaning. No? When I lose sight of that, that means I'm out of balance. I'm too disturbed, too agitated, too covered. I'm losing sight of the purpose of things. I'm just being carried away by this wave, another wave, who knows what. So I want to be in a situation where I'm not losing sight of the purpose, of the meaning of this moment, this day, this month, year, life. Again, someday we may fail, let's be honest. So I'm saying all this not in a perfectionist way, and part of the equation is we may fail, and that's part of that has to be integrated into a further balance as well, right? So you were raising your hand, yeah.
So earlier today, I was walking along the beach, and there's so many people, so many different people. And I'm here out alone in Barcelona, so when I'm alone, you know, I tend to more look. Not like when you're walking with someone, you're in a conversation, I'm looking a lot around me, and I'm reading this book, and I'm trying to be more aware of my thoughts to others, like giving blessing, for example, and like you talked about yesterday, seeing other people as being loved, and also as saints, like, you know, putting people in a positive light, and I tried to do this, and not that I expected it to be easy, but I found it to be really challenging. And like, it kind of made me feel like I'm a bit scared of looking at people, because maybe some people can bring me uncomfortable with fear, or I don't know, just unsettling feelings or thoughts, or like, what are they doing? Or yeah, there's many different things going on in the world around me. So I don't know if it's a question or what it is, but I just felt like I wanted to share it and be vulnerable, also like you talked about it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, as I mentioned, you don't need to have a question. There may be some sharing, and I appreciate your openness and willingness to translate into practice some of the things we are talking, because again, this is not just some nice words inside this room and we leave the room and it's like ideally we have to walk the talk, you know? So how to apply this and how it relate to everyone. And yeah, it's understandable what you feel, I would say. No, I wouldn't just like over push. Don't be afraid, just jump and do it fully. Because of course I don't know you, so each one of us come with our own system, let's put it that way. We may have very valid reasons to not making that quantum leap. Well, in some other cases we may need to do the quantum, to take the quantum leap. But again, each one of us have to do it from a place that is sustainable enough. Eventually, of course, ideally, at some point, we can reach a point where we won't feel threatened by the environment, because we will be so, how to say, empowered ourselves, so solidly established in our realization, and this may be something very advanced, that the environment is not affecting us negatively, but we just are affecting the environment positively always. Again, probably a very advanced stage. So as long as we are not there, that's my point, we may sometimes have to exercise some caution. No, like if I expose myself too much, if I open myself too much in this particular environment, it may be too overwhelming. I may be carried away by this whatever influence. But at the same time, the importance of reminding myself, well, but I need to open myself fully somewhere to someone. No, not to put pressure on me, but just to send that loving reminder that it's healthy to be fully transparent and vulnerable, at least with one person in our whole life. I'm not saying you will find 3,000 people to do that. Probably your 5,000 friends in Facebook won't qualify all of them. But even if you say, Swami, I have one person that I can do that, we will celebrate that. I won't tell you only one. No, that's glorious. Because, and even if there's no even one, at least have the hope that there, that one exists somewhere, and will come to our life if we are open to that, if we acknowledge that need, if we are willing to trust, to try again, giving ourselves. And again, I'm talking in a very general way, because I know that some of us may have gone through some complex situations in life where giving oneself, trusting, fully open, that can be so triggering and so traumatic. So I want to be very cautious about that. I don't want any of you to feel like pressure to do something that it doesn't feel like the moment. But I think it's healthy that from whatever stage we are now, we can ask ourselves, how can a little bit, you know, open myself a little bit more in a place that is safe and trustworthy, and gradually more and more. So yeah, it can be an intense adventure. I remember sometimes in the context of this, we do this exercise. You may have heard about that. It's very simple. I invite two people, one to sit in front of the other, generally people that they do not know each other. And just the exercise is to look at in the eyes, just in silence for as long as they can handle, many times, because that can be so intense. Because you are entering, no? You are entering. Of course, to do it from a place of love and well-wishing and trying both to receive each other and open each other. And if we have that willingness, generally the result is very moving, very magical, very empowering. But it can feel scary also. So it's important, okay, fear comes. We acknowledge that, but also eventually we may ask ourselves why fear is coming. What's the reason behind the fear? Because there's always some reason behind what we think is the ultimate cause. So to say, okay, fear is coming, why? No? Maybe it's not the moment to ask that now, but eventually we may need at one point to ask why, and connect the dots. But again, all in the context of what we were talking yesterday, of learning to love yourself, knowing yourself to be loved, having that reassurance and support, because if not, it can be overwhelming as well, right? So thanks for sharing. You raise your hand, yeah.
Related to what she said, like, even if we as in our state, mm-hmm. we cannot do that full opening to
yeah.
others.
Yeah.
In the end, it's a fear of death, because of course, if you open up to anyone in any situation fully, you might be hurt in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if in your tradition, are there people who have been fully trusting beyond the limits of being safe?
Mm-hmm.
Or there is something that where you can put like a small like distance, or is it till the end, right? Like being trusting and loving everyone, even if I can be hurt.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I write a lot about that in chapter 11 of that book, just in case. In the chapter on Guru and Disciple, there's a whole chapter in my book. And there I also try to analyze on connection with to what you mentioned, relationship like Guru-Disciple, not necessarily Guru-Disciple only, but just one example. There can be so much unhealthy openness. There can be codependency. They can be... yeah, we can be vulnerable in a way that is without discrimination, because we are so, again, each case is unique. So each one comes with their own unresolved stuff. And sometimes between guru and disciple, if there's some unresolved stuff, that ideally needs to be ascertained first. Because if not, it becomes part of a relationship and becomes so toxic. It's like a marriage. A guru disciple is like a marriage also. So like in a marriage situation or in any relationship, we can have toxic dynamics, codependency, abuse, premature vulnerability without proper boundaries, forced trust. You have to trust me, and that the person submits to that. All those things can happen also in spiritual circles. Of course, we try to provide caution, but sometimes the individuals come with their own thing. So... So I think it's important to have those boundaries set clear and to promote that every person thinks for themselves, feel for themselves, and understand that this is a gradual process. No, this is not just like something. Again, I'm talking about opening fully, being trustworthy, being this, but these are processes, right? These are not just acts. Okay, do it. No? But begin the process of trusting. It may take decades, and it's okay. Begin the process of being vulnerable. Begin the process of opening your heart. It's a day-to-day, it's a series of openings. It's not just one opening, here I am. It's a series of gradual openings. And we need to have... First of all, experience, an experience with someone that, okay, I feel comfortable with this person. I feel that I can open myself. Okay, I will open myself 1%. Let's see what happens. Oh, there was no abuse. Great. I'll open myself a little bit more. And a little bit. I would say part of the big fear in connection to your question that many of us have, of course, we could call it death, but I will say many of our great fears, and we'll talk about that tomorrow also, but it's the fear of not belonging. No, the fear of being rejected, the fear of not being part, the fear that if I open myself and they see me, they really see me, what will happen? I won't be accepted, I won't be loved, I will be rejected, I won't be part, I won't belong. And everyone needs that. You cannot survive without that. So there's this fear about the potential of not belonging, being rejected, being, of course, on a more, foundational level, technically speaking, and again, you have to realize that it's not possible not to belong. We already belong. In this, and tomorrow we'll be talking about non-duality and about how the whole of reality exists interconnected. So we are already connected. We fear so much disconnection. We fear so much separateness. But in essence, we cannot be separate and we cannot be disconnected. But we think that that's possible. And that's a problem. That's a whole illusion that we need to overcome through spirituality. To realize you already belong. You're already part of something bigger. You cannot be separate. You think you can. You think you are. And that's a whole problem. Right? And that's from where fear arises. In one of our main books, Bhagavad Purana said, Bhayam dvitiya abhinivesha tasya. And again, I don't want to spoil tomorrow's meeting. This is not a spoiler, just one word. But this verse says, from duality, when we perceive things as separate, not as a unified whole, but as a fragmented, separated, isolated set of parts, when we see reality in that dualistic framework, fear arises. When I see everything disconnected, not belonging to everything, I start to feel myself, I'm not part, I'm disconnected, I'm fragmented, and all this dread comes, existential dread and fear and anxiety, and an attempt to belong and to be part. But many times our attempts to be part and belong, by doing that, we end up compromising who we are many times. I have this need to be part, but I see that in this social circle, to be part, I need to hide this, and then I will be accepted. And we many times end up betraying ourselves, trying to belong. So the ideal is to realize you already belong, so you don't need to betray yourself. And actually, you can never belong by betraying yourself. In my book, I use these two words, belonging and fitting in.
What's fitting in?
Encajar. No. Pertenecer, encajar. That's not the same. No? So we need to belong, but many times we confuse these two things and we just try to fit in. And fit, in order to fit in, you need to stop being who you are and becoming something else. In order to belong, you need to be who you are. So I would say that one of the main fears is that, the fear of not belonging, not being part, being rejected, being alone, not being loved, not being understood. So that's why we were talking these days, the importance of knowing you are already loved, you're already accepted, you already belong in principle. And of course, we need relationships in this world that make us feel that also, because it's not enough to just say it like a metaphysical principle. Okay, everything belongs, everyone belongs, you're already loved and accepted. And you say, yeah, but I never experienced that with anyone here. So also we need very concrete experiences in which we really feel, oh my gosh, I'm really accepted for who I am. I'm encouraged to be honest. And the more honest I am, the more I share my embarrassment, the more I'm accepted. The other day I was listening to a lecture of someone. He was talking about AA, like Alcoholics Anonymous. And basically the ethic of that group is basically that. If you enter the group, the circle, and you start to fake who you are, you are rejected. The more you become honest about your most embarrassing things, the more you are accepted. And this person was saying, I never experienced something like that. No, I experienced the opposite generally. I need to fake and to perform and to make a facade to be accepted. But here they're asking me to be who I am. As simple as that. So that's what we actually call, as we were talking yesterday, satsanga. Contact with that type of quality connections, that we can really be ourselves. We are encouraged to be ourselves. So the more we connect with those people, with those experiences, I will say, the more we can overcome this fear, and we become more grounded in I am who I am, and I accept it, and I'm loved, and I don't need to hide anything. And if someone cannot understand that, okay, I'm not criticizing that person, I'm not judging that person. I may take to take a healthy distance from that person, but I cannot betray myself. I am who I am, and I'm trying to do my best. But by being who I am in proper connections, I will get this feeling of I'm already belonging. I don't need to fit in. I can eliminate that word from my vocabulary. Something like that. Okay. Something else before we conclude? Okay. We can put the discussion to rest for today. And of course, if you have time, willingness, invited. Tomorrow we have one last session, same time. Tomorrow we'll be talking a little bit on, just gave the trailer now, on non-duality, which is, I think, is a very important point on understanding how the whole of existence is connected and whole. Not whole with age, but whole with all be complete. And in that, from that perspective, also we'll extend the discussion to how to see the material world, the world of matter, as something sacred, and how we can relate to matter in a way that can bring further disclosure of the divine. So thank you so much for your time, for your presence again.